Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Hello, welcome, and thank you for listening to the latest episode of Borders Blatherings, the podcast where Mary Craig and I shine a light on the curious, the shadowy, and the often very magical history of the Scottish Borderlands. Mary, hi.
Hello, hello.
It's been a few weeks since we got together in this kitchen here to record something.
It is, yes. We were posted missing in action for a couple of weeks.
There was the Christmas and Hogmanay break, yeah. And a little bit of illness. But everything's back to normal. I have rather a busy brain and think too much sometimes. Couple of things that I have been thinking about recently, which might lead us into what I'd like to talk to you about today.
Sure, okay.
First thought was maybe we should script something, but here we go.
Here we go again.
I shall pick your brains about this. Cassie, walking of a morning with young Cassie, old Cassie, I often pass the Stow Town Hall.
Yeah.
And that is where the local history archive is located.
Yes, indeed, yes.
The archive, I should add, that you curate most magnificently.
Thank you very much.
And a feature that you've added quite recently is the notice board outside, the chalkboard.
Little chalkboard.
And
yes.
Cassie and I stop religiously and we read what's on. It's essentially this day in history.
It is, yes.
And I noticed in the run up to Christmas, and maybe because of Armistice Day approaching or something, a lot of the stuff that you were mentioning was events that took place on this day. That day, during the 1418 War, the Great War.
Yes.
And what was reassuring about it was sometimes it would be the result of a local bowling match between Stow and the nearby village of Lodder, which was reassuring because I thought there's this horrific war going on.
Yes.
Yet we're down, you're the magpie historian, we're down to these reassuring little things that life goes on.
Yes, it does.
And that was reassuring and comforting in some way. I will not mention the phrase I'm now about to mention, providing comfort for the troops, which I love.
Yes.
But to carry on. That made me think about dusting off one of my own DVD archives. And rather than The Great Escape or It's a Wonderful Life, between Christmas and Hogmanay, we watched, for the second time, a movie called Joyeux Noël. Have you come across that?
No, I don't know this.
It'll be, I don't do dates, it's probably mid-2000s when it was released. And if you give me a minute, I'll just quickly skim over the fact, because it brings in what I'd like to chat about today. It's the mid-2000s. It's a French-German-British collaboration project. And it focuses on the Great War. And it tells the developing story through six different people. If I remember, there are two Scots, one of whom is a chaplain. There is a German tenor opera singer. There's a French lieutenant and so on. And on Christmas Day, or Christmas Eve, in fact, there's this really beautiful, poignant scene where the Scots in the trenches start singing songs of homeland, the homeland. You know the thing. And then the German tenor, who is one of the main characters, pipes up with Stille Nacht. Which for us is Silent Night.
Which is so beautiful, yes.
That then is this wonderful riposte where the Scottish bagpiper then echoes. And so you have the bagpipes playing and the German tenor singing Stille Nacht. And slowly the troops emerge from the trenches. Mm-hmm. It is this very well-known, shall I say, informal truce that takes place at Christmas in 1914.
That's right, yes.
Where enemies become friends. And gifts are exchanged. Chocolate, wine. And of course the football match is played. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think it went to penalties, so let's not worry about that. And there's a small part in this when the French lieutenant says to, I've forgotten, Audebert, says to the German soldier that he's talking to, mm-hmm. Your French is very good.
Uh-huh.
He says, oh, actually, my wife is French. And so you have this melding together of friends becoming, enemies becoming friends. And I think you'll know better than I, but I think the Hygieians further up were not particularly in favor of this informal truce.
They were absolutely furious.
Get back to your day job.
Yes.
So it's a beautiful movie. Mm. And I think it reminded me of what we share potentially being more powerful than what divides us.
Yes. Yes.
So I wanted to link your little notice board to me remembering that film, mm-hmm. Joyeux Noël, mm-hmm. and going back to that, reminding myself of that message. So today's topic is, I think, the Great War.
The Great War, indeed.
Now, I call it the Great War rather than the First World War. Why so? Do you call it the Great War or the First World War?
I call it the Great War because just after it was over, that's what it was called. Uh-huh. There was no thought that there would be a second Great War, a second World War.
Yeah.
And it was the war to end all wars. Indeed. We weren't going to have another worldwide conflict, or that was what had been hoped.
Yeah.
Although, unfortunately, that, as we know, did not pan out. But yes, it's the Great War to me. It's not the First World War or World War One.
Yeah. So without the benefit of a script, that's where I wanted to go today.
Yes.
My thought was you're a magpie historian.
I have to say that.
So rather than talk about, for the moment, you know, great leaders, great events, Passchendaele, the song, we go down to the micro level and talk about events, stories.
Yes.
Things that were happening here in the borders.
Yes.
In the lead up to.
Yes.
And during. This war.
This great war, yes. Yes, I mean, if you start off, you have to start off with the death of Victoria, if you like, going into the Edwardian era. And the thing was that the weather, for once, and for anybody hearing any noises in the background, it's extremely windy today, so apologies for that.
I am hoping nothing comes through the kitchen glass
If a tree
doors.
Starts to fall towards us, you might hear a few expletives, but never mind, we'll keep going.
It's a tad stormy out
anyway,
there.
Anyway, for the first part of the 20th century, the weather was relatively benign in Britain and relatively benign in the borders.
Yeah.
So everybody's having a lovely time. Victoria had died. Now, Victoria loved the Highlands. Edward comes to the throne. He preferred the Lowlands because he had a tense relationship with his mama, as he called her. So if she liked something, he would not like it. So he tended to like the borders.
Right.
So he came for the hunting, shooting, fishing in the borders. There's lots of sheep to learn about the place. It's fat farmland. Everybody's actually digging along quite nicely. The mills are doing really, really well.
Yeah.
We're getting raw materials in and finished products out because there are railways. It's the height of the railways. We've got the British Empire flourishing, and there's all sorts of exciting new foods. Curry has appeared. Ooh, exciting stuff. All sorts of good things are happening.
It's a bit like today, then. Everything's hunky-dory.
Everything's hunky-dory.
Excellent. Good news.
So for the first 10, 14 years of the 20th century, everybody in the borders is quite happy, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Now, things are happening out in the world. We know that. We know that Germany, which is a relatively new nation, has got the Kaiser, who keeps jumping up and down and saying he wants a bigger navy than us. But so what? He was related to our royal family, so although he's sort of blustered about the place, there was no threat there.
He loved his boats.
You know, it was fine. He was a bit of a blowhard, but we didn't really care about that.
Mm-hmm.
You had the tottering old empire of Austria, but that was, well, it was miles away, and it's Austria. It's got nothing to do with us, so we didn't really care about that. We had, some of us had vaguely heard of the Balkans, weren't quite sure what they were, was it a people, was it a country, was it a mountain range, but, you know, things happened there.
Well, I was told again, by my history teacher, it was the sick man of Europe.
Well, there we are, you see, so, you know, the only thing that was really bothering us was Ireland, because the Irish were saying things like, well, we don't want to be part of Britain anymore. We want home rule. Mm-hmm. So that was where our focus was. But again, that's all they were doing. They were going through the Parliament, Parnell and De Valera, and were pushing for things like that. Mm-hmm. We had a standing army that fought in the Boer War. But other than that, there was no conscription. There was nothing like that. Everything was good. And so you get to the summer of 1914, and the Borders is having a great time. Because people are coming here for their holidays, because there's nice hunting and shooting and fishing and walking, and the wool's fine. And then some archduke somewhere gets shot somewhere called Sarajevo, and where's that? And does it really matter? And, you know, all the politicians, and maybe the front page of the paper says, oh, trouble in the Balkans, but we don't know where they are. And the Kaiser shouts a wee bit, but then he goes on his summer holidays. And so there were people from the Borders at the end of July 1914, going on holiday to Germany. And then August comes along and we're at war.
Yeah.
And people were genuinely surprised. People were sort of going, oh, okay, we're at war with Germany? What's going on here? So we thought, okay, fine. And they say, right, come on, lads, you all have to join up. And a few folk from the Borders went, do we? We've got a standing army. Why do I need to join up? And a few folk did. A few young lads went, oh, it's going to be exciting. And, you know, the British Expeditionary Force gets sent over. Most mothers are saying things like, where do you think you're going? Oh, I'm going on a great big adventure, Mum. And that was great at first, it's August, September, and it's all rallying round and all the rest of it. And there was a few people that thought, oh, it might get me out of the harvest, because harvest is quite hard work, actually. I can go to the army and they pay you a wage and I won't actually have to work on the farm. Oh, this is a good game. So a few folk took off.
Yeah, because a lot of the young people will be farm labourers and working on the land in this part of the world.
Of course they are. So they're thinking, actually, because summertime is when you can sort of relax in the farming season. Yeah. But then, of course, you're going into the autumn and it's really, really hard. And there was lots of extra work in the mills because the army is saying, well, we need, you know, army jackets and we need rugs and we need, you know, all sorts of things, blankets and everything. Yeah. So that's great. And there was a few people that thought they might be able to sell a few horses to the army. So that's good. So the Borders is thinking, oh, don't quite know how long this wee war with Germany is going to last, but it's not going to really come to anything very much. You know, it's really just France and Germany shouting at each other or whatever. We'll go over for a bit, make some money. And it'll all be over by Christmas, remember?
Yeah.
There were folk in the Borders that were not happy. The Duke of Buccleuch and the Duke of Roxburgh and the big landowners and the big farmers are saying, where do you think you're going? Wait a minute, harvest is coming round the corner. Where do you think you're off to? Want you to leave, thank you very much. And the mill owners are saying, well, this is great. We're getting all these big orders in, so we don't want to lose anybody to the army because we need those looms going to make as much money as we can.
So we support the war in principle, but keep your hands off my guys.
Exactly. I'm not losing my rabbit catcher. I'm not losing my gamekeeper. These sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there was this. But again, because the war was so sort of vague and it was Germany and France who were arguing with each other over Alsace-Lorraine and where's that and is that a person, is that a lassie called Lorraine? We didn't really quite know in the Borders, you know.
That's where they make quiche.
Is that, where that come from, you know. So at first it was sort of confusing and confused. Yeah. And because, of course, the war wasn't in Britain, it wasn't in the Borders, we didn't see it. And so things like, we went off, the British Expeditionary Force went off, and we know that the war sort of really starts to kick off. And of course, Germany have got their Schlieffen plan, and they're sweeping round France, coming into Paris in the back. And there are lots of things like this in the Borders paper. So the Border Telegraph or the Kelso Chronicle, they're saying the Schlieffen plan. And we're thinking, oh, how do you pronounce that word? And Moltke and all these exciting names. And they had diagrams on the front page which you could look at over your porridge in the morning.
Yeah.
But it was exciting or vaguely interesting or after a while a bit boring because nothing much was really happening for the first couple of months. And then it kicked in. Then it starts to kick in when we realise that it's not all going to be over by Christmas. Uh-huh.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Because the journalists would have thought, well, you know, if the German army goes through Belgium,
yeah,
the Belgians will fire one shot in the air and surrender.
Exactly.
And then all over. Sleeping plan, perfect.
Yeah. So we didn't understand this. So, of course, at this point, you have people thinking, well, what does this actually mean? And all of a sudden conscription, all of a sudden recruitment comes in, and all of a sudden the propaganda comes in. The beastly Hun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, the mums that were saying things like, where do you think you're going, you're not joining up, are turning into people and saying, right, get yourself down to the recruiting office in Galashiels and Hoyk and get signed up for the KOSB, the King's Own Scottish Borderers.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a real change when we realised that, okay, right, this is a war, okay, right, bring it on sort of type thing.
Yeah.
But again, the big landowners, they get really worried at this point and they start looking for exemptions for their workers and they go in piling in these exemptions. Everybody, you can't take my rabbit trapper, you can't take my ghillie, you can't take my gamekeeper, you can't take my forester, you can't take. And what they were asking for was a complete exemption. Now, they seldom got that, but what they would get is they would get a 3-month exemption or a 9-month exemption.
So the MOD had a system in place to allow the rich landowners to get temporary exemptions
Always been a system whereby if you had a doctor's note to say you had a gammy leg or something, you could get out of getting conscripted into the army. Because we had that during the Covenanter Royalist War. It was quite interesting to see the number of people who, you know, daddy was pally with a local doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ministry of War did have a system in place, but it was seldom used. But all of a sudden, they are getting hundreds of applications coming in. And so initially they were giving postponements of 3 months and 9 months. And most of the landowners were okay with that because they're thinking, right, the 3-month one, that gets me over the season, or the 9-month one, that gets me to next harvest or whatever.
Yeah.
And they just assumed that when that one ran out, if this silly little war was still ongoing, they'd put in another exemption, and that didn't work. And they got really angry about this because they were losing workers. Because being a gamekeeper is a skilled job.
Oh, yeah.
Being a rabbit trapper is a skilled job. It's not just that you're going in to put biscuits in a box in a factory. You have to know the land. You have to know what you're talking about. And, of course, remember, at this point, women don't really work in that sense. So you can't have a woman gamekeeper.
Yeah.
You can't have that. You know, so you've got all of that going on. And then, of course, the army starts requisitioning horses. Now, horses from the countryside did not go to the front. The army horses that were in the army barracks, that were trained army horses, went to the front, the country horses went to the army. So if you're Dobbin and you're used to pulling a plough in Selkirk in January 1915, you are not going to end up in the front in 5 months. What you're going to do is you're going to replace the horse that's been taken out of the barracks.
And put it in the front.
Now, as the war goes on, this continues, however. It stops right about, it continues for a while and then it stops because they realise that charging horses towards machine guns doesn't work. It took them a while to realise that. But the horses that were predominantly used in the war were actually pit ponies from Wales because they were used along, because you can't take a big shire horse and stick it in a trench. Too big. You want a nice wee pit pony. Goodness knows what these poor wee blind pit ponies thought of being dragged out of mine and now you're in a trench. Goodness knows. But again, horses were getting requisitioned for the work. So you're not getting, fields are not getting ploughed because you don't have a ploughman. And if you do have a ploughman, you don't have the horses. You're having to share horses. You're having to share equipment like that. So that's really annoying the landowners at that level. But it means for the guy that is doing the ploughing, he doesn't have his ordinary, he doesn't have his horse. Being a ploughman is a skilled job. You have a team of horses you've worked with. You've maybe trained those horses for 10, 20 years, and now all of a sudden you've got to borrow a horse for one guy and borrow another horse for somebody else, and those two horses don't know each other. They've never worked in harness before. So this affects how you're able to do your job as an ordinary ploughman in the borders. It's obviously not the same consequence as your brother who's in a trench getting shot at. But it does mean that your life is affected by all of this, over and above the stress of the fact that your brother's in a trench getting his head shot at. You know, so all of these things are putting increasing pressure on people. And the border really bears a lot of the brunt of this. Because the KOSB was a very proud regiment. The Kingsland Scottish Borders is an old regiment. It's a proud regiment. And they were shipping folk off as quick as they could get them through training. And they were pulling lads from the borders. And they pulled a lot of men. They pulled a lot of men out the mills. Because the lassies could take over the looms. The girls that were in there doing spinning and weaving take a step up. And older retired weavers could step
come
in.
Back.
And so the mills were affected in that way. And it did change a lot of things. So there were, you know, for all this war kicks off in August 14, by the spring of 15, the summer of 15, the borders is really starting to feel the effects of that.
And this has affected a change of attitude in general towards the war effort. Out of interest, was there once the in full swing sounds complimentary? War's going, is there much evidence of conscientious objection at all, or are people more than happy to enlist?
It's mixed. You do get the conscientious objectors, some of whom refused to join up completely and ended up in prison. Many of whom joined up, but they were, stretcher bearers. That was what they did. So they wouldn't fight, but they would do their bit. And they were sort of tolerated. But the government's got the propaganda machine in full swing at this point, and you are getting the white feather handed to young lads if you weren't in the army. What you tended to get was actually people hurting themselves. Now, the borders is a very rural area. And farming and working on the land is a very dangerous
occupation. It's dangerous anyhow.
So it's amazing how many people manage to chop off things like their trigger finger. Because if you haven't got a trigger finger, then you're no use to the army. So a lot of youngish men seem to lose trigger fingers, or they would get themselves shot in the foot. Now, the government got very wise to this, and what would happen is you'd get conscripted anyway and chucked into the army to a desk job, so at least you weren't going in the trenches, but they weren't letting you away with that nonsense. But if you think about it, if you're going to chop off your trigger finger, if you're going to maim yourself and give yourself a limp, okay, you're not going to get sent to the trenches. You're not going to go to the Somme or Ypres or Passchendaele. How are you going to work as a farm labourer for the rest of your life if you have deliberately maimed yourself? You know, this isn't an easy thing. People say, oh, well, they chopped off their trigger finger. How do you work a loom with no trigger finger? How do you work a loom if you have damaged your hands? Or how do you work the land if you've damaged your feet or your legs in some way? So it has real repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, on top of that, because the German Navy was up and was strong, and oh boy, was it strong, shipping was affected. Merchant shipping was affected.
Mm.
And as I said earlier, we had got used to the finer things of life.
Indeed, yeah.
The British Empire was, you know, pear soap and tapioca and curry and exciting things like this.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they weren't there. And it's very difficult to adjust your diet down the way. You can adjust your diet up the way very easily, but to adjust it down the way psychologically, you think, oh, I don't want just boring old rice pudding anymore. I want rice pudding with jam. So you had things like this. And you did have rationing. Now, not in the way we had rationing in the Second World War, but there was rationing. There were restrictions.
Yeah.
It did become more difficult for you to buy food. It did become more difficult for you to get cloth because certainly the mills were entirely supplying the army. So things like that changed as well.
Mm.
And you get a situation where you see women are more often girls than boys. And when at that stage where they're still growing, you know, sometimes boys will be sort of like, you know, 1.50 meters, and then suddenly they shoot up the way boys will do. And they're wearing trousers. You think, why are they so short? There wasn't the clothing for them to wear. And they would often be wearing clothing that was very much out of date because what you'd do is you'd haul granddad's old suit from the back of the cupboard and cut that down for your son because that's all there was to wear. So again, now fair enough, you're clothed, but nobody wants to be wearing granddad's suit when you're 15 and 16 years old.
It's not like
so
today at all.
All these things are having a huge effect on what's going on over and above the psychology of the fact that your dad, your older brother, your uncle, your son, your cousin, your best friend is in a trench getting shot at. Mm-hmm. And the government tried as much as they could to say, oh, it's all very jolly and we're winning. But we weren't winning. 1915 becomes 1916, becomes 1917, becomes 1918. It is very difficult to think we are winning. And it's very difficult when the telegram boy turns up at your door with the telegram, the Black Edge telegram, time and time and time again. Because you do get families in the borders where three and four sons joined together. And three out of those four boys died.
And this, sorry to interrupt, but this idea of PALS groups, was that enforced during the Great War, where they put people from the same locale together in regiments?
They didn't tend to do that as much here. Now, you got in Lancashire and Yorkshire, you had the PALS brigades, the PALS battalions, which was just devastating.
Indeed.
If you take all the young men from one area. Because Scotland's slightly different, most people in the borders joined the KOSB.
Mm-hmm.
But there were enough people in the borders who had drifted down from the Highlands. So what you, because of the Highland clearances, so what you would do is you would join the regiment that your father or your grandfather, so you'd join the Black Watch.
Or the Gordons
or the
someone like
or
that.
The Cameronians or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you didn't get entire villages in that way, but you still did get people all joining up together. You know, and of course, the letter home that you were writing from the trenches was, well, you know, the food's a bit rubbish and the weather's a bit rubbish, but, you know, it's great you should join up because if you write anything negative, that letter is not getting through the censors.
Indeed, indeed.
And again, if you're a 14, 15-year-old, but it's very difficult. War, we see war on the television today or the internet if there's a war going on. We can see the horrors of war. If you don't see it, if you don't understand the reality of it, and your big brother is in France drinking wine, chatting up mademoiselles, and you're stuck at home with mum and dad and a baby sister that's annoying you, and you think, well maybe, and everybody says it's great, and you're doing your bit for king and country, and you get a shiny uniform, and you get wages. So there are a lot of mixed messages.
And
most of the lads that got leave didn't come home to the borders because there wasn't enough time and there wasn't the transport to come home. So you get, you know, you get two weeks leave from the trench. Fine. You're going to go back to your base in France because you haven't got time to go back to the base and then get a ship to take you to Dover and then Dover and the train all the way back up to the borders. By the time you've got here, you've got to turn around and go home again. And can you afford it? Yeah. And is there a train that will take you?
That mixed messaging is fascinating because albeit this was during the Second World War, my father served in then Burma and Ceylon as a backup technician guy with the RAF.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I'm born 51, and I remember the fondness with which my father spoke about his experiences during the war, the camaraderie, and it was almost as if the best times in his life
was in the army
during war.
Yes.
It's a very strange thing for me as a wee boy, to hear that.
Yeah.
But I really remember that well.
Yeah.
Talking of back to the Great War, talking of shortages and wearing granddad's cut down suit and so on. Is there any archival evidence of, I'm thinking Private Walker in Dad's Army, SPIVs operating in the area, people who are exploiting the black market and in food and other supplies?
We do have a few, but not nearly as many. It's more a Second World War because of the rationing. But one thing we did have during the First World War was that villages and towns could club together and buy a bit of equipment for the army. So you can club together and you'd have a bring and bake sale and all the ladies would knit woolly hats or whatever and sell them. And you might buy a bit of a wing or you might buy a bit of a something for a tank. So people have got their relatives out fighting, the economy's flatlining, and yet you're expected to rally around. And these were often led by the church. There you go, I got the church in.
I was coming to that.
Oh, yeah. And the Kirk of Scotland, you'd have a sort of special jumble sale at the church and raising funds for the army, and you would buy army bonds so that you would be raising money for the army. Because the thing is that Germany had been a young country. It was only formed, from 1871. Their economy was boundless. I mean, the iron ore, the steel production, the Krupp's factories. I mean, Krupp's was amazing. Yeah. I mean, the towns he built, babies born in Krupp hospitals with Krupp nurses and doctors and all the rest of it. I mean, the workers worked hard, but the paying conditions they had were immense.
And there was a lot of British private investment in many of these companies,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely, yes. So, Germany had the wherewithal to keep things going that we hadn't, because, as I say, we hadn't been paying attention to what was going on. We'd been thinking our problem was the Irish, because the Irish were kicking off and they wanted home rule. Everything in the empire was fine. Germany was upset. Germany and France were annoyed at each other over Alsace-Lorraine.
Yeah.
Germany was worried that it might get encirclement. The French knew this.
You'd have the Franco-Prussian War, and so that score's not settled.
What the French do is the French pile a whole load of money into Russia to allow Russia to build railways, which meant that Russian troops could attack Germany on its east flank.
So heading towards Germany,
And France could attack the west flank. So Germany's concerns about encirclement were genuine concerns, but we hadn't been paying attention to that. The fact that Austria said to Germany, we've got problems with the Slavs, would you back us up because our army's not very great? And the Kaiser, with his pride, thinking, well, yes, I'll say yes, and that means Russia will back down and that'll be a political coup for me.
Yeah.
We hadn't been paying any attention to any of this. We had just been worried about the fact that the Germans had this bigger navy than us. So when push comes to shove, by the time you're into 1916, pushing into 1917, our war effort is failing. We are starting to this is why when America comes into the war, we're like, oh, for goodness sake, thank goodness for that. Because our industry was on its knees.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the propaganda in a lot of places had worked too well.
Uh-huh.
So all the men had tootled off to war. You're like, oh, flip, forgot about that. And because we weren't getting our exports in from the empire, we were toiling, so we turned round to people in the borders and other areas and said, can you raise the money for a plane or whatever it was?
Yeah. You're talking about the church's involvement and this idea of the WRVS baking a victorious sponge. This is providing comfort for the troops.
Yes. Yes.
This is this British, what's the one? We're all in
it. We're all in it together. We're doing our bit.
This collective psyche thing that is a British thing, I think, and it's true today.
Yes.
You know, this is for me, a piece of propaganda that works. Mm-hmm. We're all in this together.
Yep. You have women in the church sitting, knitting socks, gloves, and balaclavas for the Navy. And everybody goes, oh, isn't that lovely? That's... Yeah. No, the Navy should have been providing men with balaclavas. It's flipping freezing cold on a ship. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do that, you know. And this is the problem. This, you know, the war slogs on and slogs on. And, of course, eventually the horrors of the war become known. So fewer and fewer people are being conscripted. But the point is, they've already gone. The horses have already gone. The young men have already gone. And so when you get to the end of the war and everybody's relieved at the end of the war, the home front had had four and a half years of disruption.
Yeah.
Four and a half years of rural work being disrupted, because it's not like women could drive the trams in Edinburgh or Glasgow, because that's a machine. You can operate a machine. You don't need the physical strength. You know, being a forester or picking up a sheep when it's about to have these are physically hard jobs to do.
Yeah.
And so they're really good. Oh, they're very skilled. But, you know, and I'm not saying that women can't do them. But if you are not trained to do that, mm-hmm. and after 4 years of that, that's a long, hard slog. And then, of course, what you start to get, and they start to trickle back at the end of the war, and possibly we might have to talk about this a lot longer, what starts to trickle back at the end of the war is the men who are maimed and the men who survived the war, but they're coming back blind. They've lost an arm. They've lost a leg. They've lost their minds with what they've seen and what they've gone through. You have families. Instead of it being a joyful homecoming, it's a horrific homecoming.
Yes.
And you now have, this sounds brutal, but it's true, another mouth to feed that is not contributing to the rural household. And a lot of that happened in the borders area.
The impact on the borders has been substantial. As I was talking at the introduction and listening to myself, I thought, this is maybe going to be longer than one episode.
Indeed, yes.
Because what we're doing now is we're starting to talk about the aftermath of this horrific war. And I do have questions for you about that, as I've been making some notes as I listen to you speaking, and the plethora of war memorials that were built, how we looked after those returning from war. When I lived in America, whether it be for reasons of guilt over Vietnam or whatever, I don't know, but I did notice when I was living both in Florida and on Cape Cod, there were many organizations supporting vets, war mm-hmm. veterans. Mm-hmm. They were treated with a great deal of respect.
Yes.
And I may be wrong, but my feeling was that sometimes here, that type of respect and protection was not offered to many of the returning troops. So if it's okay with you, I think we maybe move into a second episode about the Great War. Talk about the aftermath, and maybe, because I'm not the expert historian, talk about the causes of this war, because I know that retrospectively, it's almost as if Germany alone has become responsible for the Great War. This worries me very much.
Yeah.
This worries me very much.
Yeah.
So maybe you and I could just pick through
that. Absolutely, yes.
And go on to talk about the aftermath, because I suspect not only did the war itself impact greatly on the Scottish borders, it had a major negative impact on agriculture, on the mills and so on, that we can actually talk about the ongoing aftermath of this war.
Great War. Absolutely.
Duce et decorum est pro patria mori.
Indeed.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.